The Equity Manifesto. It begins by joining together, believing in the potency of inclusion, and building from a common bond. It embraces complexity as a cause for collaboration, accepting that our fates are inextricable. It recognizes local leaders as national leaders, nurturing the wisdom and creativity within every community as essential to solving the nation's problem. It demands honesty and forthrightness, calling out racism and oppression, both overt and systematic. It strives for the power to realize our goals while summoning the grace to sustain them. It requires that we understand the past without being trapped in it, embrace the present without being constrained by it, and look to the future, guided by the hopes and courage of those who have fought before and beside us. This is equity, just and fair inclusion into a society in which all can participate, prosper, and reach their full potential, unlocking the promise of the nation by unleashing the promise in us all.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of American Daisies. I am Arjun.
And I'm an incredible reader.
Otherwise known as Akash. We are here on a Sunday afternoon in the Oakland offices of Policy Link. And we are sitting here. We are very blessed to have with us Anand Subramanian. Almost got that.
Subramanian. It's like a...
Subramanian.
It's like got to be a top five South Indian last name.
I would say top three.
I was going to say three, but I don't know enough to just make such a bold claim. Yeah.
And he is the associate director here at Policy Link. And thank you for being on the show today.
No, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for doing this podcast. I think it's really important to have something like this out there. So, props.
Thanks, man. Appreciate
so what it. I just read was your equity manifesto, right? First of all, I read a lot of words, didn't understand any of them. Can you explain that to dumb people who may or may not be me? And second of all, you said there's a difference, you said this to Arjun, between equality and equity. What would be that difference?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing that equity manifesto. That's something that our organization started to put together and promote right before one of our summits, equity summits, in the fall of 2015. And so I think the definition of equity that we like to use was contained within the manifesto, which is just and fair inclusion. So just and fair inclusion so that all may participate and prosper in our society and in our economy. So I think what we're looking at really is starting with the people that you want to try to support, as opposed to starting with, say, policies or starting with anything that is more high level. So you really want to see where different populations are situated and identify barriers that they may be facing, and then come up with policy, say, to address specific barriers that those populations are facing. So one good definition I've seen recently that talks about the difference between equity and equality is more that everyone has the same sort of opportunity. And equity is ensuring that people have a chance for the same outcomes. So,
oh wow,
yeah. So there's this really famous graphic that has a tall dude, a medium height dude, and like a small dude on the left trying to look over a fence at a baseball game, and the tall person can kind of, and they're all standing on one box each, and so the tall person can see it easily. The middle person kind of has to like look up a little bit and can kind of see the game. The short person can't see it at all. But then you have equity on the other side where the tall person has one box or doesn't have any box because they don't really need it at all. The middle person has one box and the shorter person has like two or three boxes. So it kind of gets at the outcome where everyone can see the game, but it's not like everyone just gets one box.
Right.
Yeah.
So in general, do you think, maybe this is a stupid question, but do you think we don't need to fight for equality? We need to fight for equity? Is that... Equality is not enough, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think equality is not enough. If equality is defined as everyone has the same chance right now, if we start right now and you give everyone the same chance, you're ignoring history, ignoring why people and populations may be situated differently now because of like historical policies that led to some of these outcomes that are disparate now. So, for instance, if you talk about redlining, which is... Are you familiar with redlining?
I've heard of it, but yeah. I don't actually.
I'm familiar with nothing.
Yeah, okay. So this is kind of a famous example that equity advocates bring up because it's a specific policy that really affected black populations in this country in a different way than, say, white populations. So in the aftermath of World War II with the GI Bill, the GI Bill allowed returning veterans to sort of qualify for different benefits, including student loans and other things. The FHA, which was the Federal Housing Administration, explicitly put together a map that had traditionally or historically black neighborhoods in red, and gave them like the worst grade in terms of how good of an investment it would be to like to give a loan out for someone to buy a house in that neighborhood. And then the sort of bordering neighborhoods were assigned the next worst level up, and then sort of typically or traditionally white neighborhoods. And of course, there was a lot of segregation at this time, and of course there is now. Those were assigned the best sort of credit worthiness.
So that, what does that mean? That means that those people in those neighborhoods, it was harder for them to get loans, or it was harder for other people, or it would be a bad investment for other people in that neighborhood. What would...
Yeah, so those were guidelines to provide FHA loans to people who wanted
saying.
To buy property, right? So, I mean, that's just one example of how the government has set policy to create some of these disparities that we see today.
Sorry, I got to just get one more clarification.
Yeah, sure.
So for the... It was guidelines for the FHA to get loans for that area or from... people from that community, it was hard, like bad idea to give those communities loans.
Don't give black people loans.
I mean, that's kind of what it boils down to.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure that I was understanding that.
I mean, yeah, it's basically the FHA, they give loans, right? And so to the extent that they would not approve loans to people who wanted to buy in black neighborhoods, typically black people,
right.
They were not allowed to qualify for those loans. And these are like super low interest loans or like, you know, and this right after World War II, buying property and houses in that time is really what led to a huge influx of wealth for a ton of American families.
Mm, right.
So when you have, you know, so after the Great Recession, for instance, the wealth gap between the median white family and the median black family was 20 to 1. Some studies say 22 to 1. And you can sort of directly point to the redlining as one of the seeds for how this wealth disparity started.
So you're saying there was equality because everyone could get a loan, but there wasn't equity because they weren't giving everyone a loan.
Yeah, exactly. So technically, black people had the right to get a loan, right?
Right.
So this is, but they were not able to qualify for loans in the neighborhoods where they were allowed to live, largely
right.
because of redlining.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So people who are fighting for equality, idiots?
Definitely not. Just I think the analysis has to be a little bit more nuanced.
They have the opportunity to be smarter, but they're not smarter.
Yeah, and I don't think it's about intelligence as much.
Sometimes you just got to ignore his jokes.
No, it's a great question. It's a great question because I think it's still, you know, a ton of people fight for equality still. And I think...
are those people that are fighting for equality simply just misguided? They just don't... Are they actually what they're looking for is equity? And they just... It's not... Equity hasn't taken hold as, like, the primary, like, language and primary definition for what we should fight for?
Yeah, I mean, that definitely may be it. I think in some circumstances, that's exactly right. Like, some people may mean equity when they say equality.
Right.
But I think there's also the danger, though, that... If you don't do an equity analysis, and we work on policy here, so that I'll talk again about policy. But if you don't, if someone proposes a policy, let's say there's a policy to give everyone, every community, like a certain amount of money for construction projects. If you don't evaluate exactly how that money will be used for what neighborhoods, who's going to be hired, what will the construction go towards? Will it go towards luxury apartments or will it go towards, you know, low-income housing or affordable housing? On the surface, it might sound good. Like, let's give every community, if the federal government wants to give every community like a, you know, a stimulus and inject money into their communities, on the surface, it sounds like it's equal. It sounds like it's a great idea, but actually it may exacerbate existing like disparities in those communities unless you have an equity analysis.
So let's transition into what this is, this organizing policy link.
Yeah.
One of the things that was interesting for us as we were approaching you to work, this isn't a specifically South Asian organization. You know, we've talked to several people at SALT and we were just over at the Asian Law Caucus. Like, these are very specific to this. Is it interesting to navigate, like, How do you navigate working with such a big umbrella when there's so many communities that are different and have different needs? And how does that fit into what you guys have to do? How are you conscious of that while you're doing your work?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. Full disclosure, I'm on the SALT board, so I totally support and love SALT. And they're doing amazing work. You know, I think both are needed. I think we need organizations that specifically focus on communities of color and other communities and their specific needs. And PolicyLink, we technically just focus on ensuring or trying to advance equity for low-income communities and communities of color. So that's very broad. Mm-hmm. And in different contexts, depending on what we're working on, we may need to target specific communities within that broader definition. So, for instance, I used to work with the California Alliance for Boys and Men of Color, which was, it's a statewide coalition that tries to improve outcomes for boys and men of color in California in education, safety and justice, health, workforce, et cetera. And the four...
Now, did you split it? Because it's interesting to me that it's boys and men versus women. Was it split because that community you find needed different things than girls and women?
Yeah. So when that decision was initially made, there was the decision to focus on boys and men of color because boys and men of color face unique barriers to success in the policy areas I mentioned. So education, safety and justice, for instance. At the time, you know, the studies indicated that boys and men of color, for instance, were more criminalized than women in general, and certainly than white men, boys and men. But even within that boys and men of color sort of broad population, the narrow focus is on Black men and boys, Latino men and boys, Southeast Asian men and boys, and Native American men and boys in California, because those were the specific populations in California that really faced those barriers. If you think about New York, where you guys are where you're based, you know, I don't know if you've talked to Fahad Ahmed yet, but he runs an organization called Desi's Rise Up and Moving, Desi's Rising Up and Moving, DRUM. And so...
Yeah, Deepa was talking about
that. Okay, great, yeah. And so they focus largely on Bangladeshi populations or Bangladeshi families out there. And a lot of the work that they do is about the same barriers to educational outcomes for Bangladeshi students in New York that we were working on here for other populations, because there wasn't necessarily a critical mass of Bangladeshi families in California.
Real quick question. It's going to sound like I'm being normal me, but this is an actual question.
Oh, sure.
You always say boys and men. Uh-huh. Why don't you just say males?
Yeah.
Good question.
That's a really good question. I think sometimes we do say males of color.
Again, there's a thing, I'm not, this maybe could be a comedic bit one day, but I notice a lot of these like organizations, there's always so much verbiage.
Mm-hmm.
And there's got to be a reason. They don't just say males of color. Yeah, boys and men, to me, I'm like, what?
Right.
Save a couple syllables.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
And I think, I actually, as recently as early this year, worked on our communications team, and partly why I joined the communications team was because I'm so fascinated by exactly how certain words resonate, what messages we're getting subliminally, like how our brain science is reacting to some of these things. I think there are two main reasons. One is that we primarily focus on boys and young men of color. So when you think about education, for instance, we're primarily talking about young men and younger. But the other reason is, and I think Deepa mentioned this too, I think it's very important to think about like anti-Blackness in this country and how Black people, what the narrative around Black men is specifically. And our perspective is, and my perspective certainly is, that the mainstream media and other sort of narrative producing industries have created this narrative about Black men that they're violent, that they're criminals, etc. And so when you talk about males, it kind of is a dispassionate term. It doesn't really humanize the population.
Oh, interesting.
And so when you talk about boys and men, young men especially, it's a little bit more personal. It's a little bit more...
A little bit more evocative.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know how sensitive of a question this is, but the term people of color often within these organizations that are working for people, mm-hmm. there's a lot with South Asians that don't face these issues. I remember in your litany of people that you were dealing with, you said Southeast Asian, but you didn't say South Asian.
Right, right.
So it's interesting for us from an identity standpoint and from like a community standpoint. How do we navigate, how much are we a part of that term, people of color, and how much are we actually not?
Right, right. And I did listen to Deepa Iyer's podcast, your podcast episode before I was able to join you guys, which was an amazing podcast. And you know, I've worked with Deepa before.
We do what we can.
Yeah. We try. You say that, I'm gonna say you need to settle down with the compliments. I'm not comfortable with any of this any longer.
Well, I will say a compliment for Deepa is that she said a lot of this way better than I ever could. And she's certainly an expert in this far more than I am in a lot of ways. But I think that in some ways, South Asian populations, and even South Asian, you kind of have to break down. So I was talking about the Bangladeshi family or Bangladeshi right. community example. Certainly they're South Asian. And, you know, some Bangladeshi families face the same barriers that these other populations that I was talking about do, these boys and men of color do. Other South Asians are more privileged and are located in a different space, don't face some of the same barriers. And so I think Deepa pointed this out, that we have to sort of ask ourselves, like, how do we identify personally? What's my community? And then sort of build out from there.
Noticed it's interesting that even with drum, like it's mm-hmm. it's Bangladeshi focused, and for whatever reason, and you know, hopefully we'll get the opportunity to ask this of them mm-hmm. at that point. But it's interesting that they didn't feel like they could say South Asian, mm-hmm. and I wonder if it's because there's such a schism in the South Asian identity that's here in America, and like how. We don't completely know how to enter the space of people of color or whiteness. Like, and we don't exactly, like in some ways we do fall in that. And you know, getting to speak with Anirvan and Barnali and hearing about the ways in which we very clearly were not in the space of whiteness, and then finding, you know, in different spaces that we are. It is an interesting thing to navigate. And
it absolutely is, yeah. And I think, Deepa's like, to me the racial bribe thing is so critical in, it's sort of the next critical question I think that the South Asian community will face, this sort of offer to get up that ladder of white supremacy.
Right.
And so to the extent that, you know, and to be clear, I think Drum, you know, they're called, they see as rising up and moving. I know that they do focus on barriers that Bangladeshis face there, but they may very well focus on other communities as well that I might not be aware of.
Mistake.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think this question of whether we're people of color or not is just really for us to answer. Do I identify as a person of color? And I definitely do. But I don't know that I would have always said yes
that's the important thing, and I think that that's what I've been learning. I mean, I myself have always, and I mean, for me it became because growing up in Tampa I just felt like an outsider, and I think that most outsider feels like the emotional reason that I would say person of color. I can't think of like the specific logistical or linear ways that I would call myself that.
Right.
But knowing our history more and learning more about that, that's what's grounded me in that identity more. And so that's an interesting, you know, because we've been openly talking about this. And listen, I'm still, as I'm learning through this, thankfully through this podcast, I'm still woefully naive to much of our history
and much
of what's going on. And so I think the grander community does face that similar obstacle.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I think you have to sort of locate it within white supremacy. And so, you know, I think that's sort of it's a trigger word or a trigger term for some people.
It could definitely be a buzzword, right?
Yeah. So for me, I mean, really, it could be as, you know, on one end it is white supremacists, like not neo-Nazis or Nazis or, you know, KKK or whatever. But on the other end, I think it's really about like white normativeness. So to what extent is whiteness the
neutral
expectation, the sort of like default, right? And are we willing to strive to achieve that default when really we can, especially when you look like we do, we clearly can't pass as white.
Right.
And to the extent that we may be privileged enough to take advantage of some of the systemic benefits that this white supremacist system has offered to us, I think we have to make that choice. Like, do we want to take advantage of that? If we do take advantage of that, then
what are your responsibilities then? Like, what price have you paid? What responsibilities do you then owe for doing that? Or do you just say, hey, I'm going to own that I did that? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that's what I'm hearing. Am I correct in what I'm hearing from you?
Yeah, and I think there's that choice is sort of present in every decision we make, like what career we decide to take, like what we decide to donate to, you know. And so And we all make that choice in some ways.
What's the whitest charity?
The whitest charity.
Well, so I'm curious though, like, because sometimes that we experience this within talking about people of color, pushback from other communities of colors that are like, feel more people of color than others, you know, this dynamic. Have you ever experienced that? You're more in touch with this work than I am, obviously. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, can you speak to that at all? Is that something that resonates in any way with your experiences?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's hard to know like how much I'm projecting and how much I'm actually facing.
Fair.
So, you know, I come into this work knowing that I come from a very privileged background. My dad was a physician. I grew up in a really, you know, higher class neighborhood. I went to an amazing private school through grade school and a public school that was fantastic. So I come from a very privileged place. I went to law school and had, you know, I worked at a law firm for a year. And that's exactly the type of choice I'm talking about. Like, because the system treats me as a son of a physician who lives in a certain neighborhood, even though I'm a dark-skinned brown man.
It treats you as white.
It offers me some of the benefits that white people get, right? Okay. And I absolutely took some of those.
Right.
And so what does that mean for working in the space where maybe someone didn't have those opportunities because they were black or Latino or Native American, maybe because they, you know, grew up in a community where they had a really bad public school because of, you know, centuries or at least decades of disinvestment. So I
think this language that you're using is incredibly important to talk about, because I think that phrasing it this way, it allows more nuance to than just, it's that you can be afforded opportunities of whiteness and not be, I don't know, it's just like a really specific and nuanced way of looking at that I think actually allows for a lot more clarity. At least I'm a lot more clarity even when I'm thinking about my own life.
Oh, that's great.
And so I just want to take a moment and say thank you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And this is all stuff I'm still thinking through, and it's like new stuff every day. I mean, you probably saw, and maybe Deepa referred to this as well, but in the sort of rise of the movement for Black Lives and the Black Lives Matter organization, a lot of ally organizations have come up. So there are ally organizations that are formed of like Asian Americans, for instance, that do a much better job than I ever could at evaluating how to best be an ally to, say, Black communities or other communities who maybe have faced more barriers historically and still currently do. And so, you know, to the extent that your question about are we really people of color, like what does that mean? Are we as, you know, of color as other communities?
Well, yeah, and I don't think there's a definition to it. I think it's just like an interest. It's not as clear for our community as it is for us. And we're very fortunate that it's, you know, I mean, that's a place of fortune. I'm not saying that this is a problem.
Right.
Just poses an interesting challenge as we're navigating society, truthfully.
Yeah.
And I do want to say, you said it comes to your choice by, like, you chose to take advantage of some of these benefits.
Sure.
But also seems to be part of your choice as to what you're doing now. Because it seems like you're passionate about, obviously you have to be in order to do this work, you're passionate about this work. So I don't know if it comes from a space of I have responsibility to those around me or not, but it feels like that's where it came from. And so that you took these benefits that you got and said, hey, I want to give back. Am I just painting a narrative with this, with your story, or is this all at all true?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely some truth to that. I mean, I really started to develop an understanding of say, structural racism during law school. So I came to it pretty late. And the way it was sort of just in front of me was I was part of a juvenile justice clinic representing these kids, literally kids, 12 and under in some cases, that were being tried as adults. I had to deal with police officers who were clearly lying. And I heard, I literally heard police officers telling each other, well, if they didn't, even if this kid didn't commit this crime, they were bound to commit some crime at some point because they were black. And to me, that was one of the first moments where I was like, whoa, this runs deep, right? It's embedded in the juvenile justice system in Chicago. And, you know, how deep does this run? So that's really when I started reading and starting to understand a little bit more about how our system was constructed to really benefit white landowners, right? Our founding fathers and the like. So that's really when I started on that journey. And I think having already gone to law school, understanding that what certain communities of color really faced were these structural and systemic barriers, that policy was the best way to try to address some of those barriers. And that's definitely why I think I came to this, especially as an attorney who had a choice to practice or work on policy. And this was the choice I made.
I want to ask a slightly tangential question about policy link and stuff. What is the makeup of the staff here? I mean, we're in a lovely office. It seems like there's a, but it's bigger than, I mean, I didn't know what to expect, but it's bigger. It's how many people work here?
Yeah.
And what is, and then my next question, can we break down some demographics of the staff here?
Sure. I mean, I think we'd have to sort of go over the staff phase for me to really identify it, but we're definitely a very diverse staff. I would say we have roughly 60 or so folks on staff, and we have an office in Oakland, and it's our home office. Our New York office is our second largest and has most of our communications team and some others. And then we have a couple of smaller offices in D.C. and in L.A. And I would say, just off the top of my head, I would say we're probably like 40 to 50% Black, and then maybe another like 10% Latino, let's say like 20% Latino and Asian, and then the rest white. Yeah, I'm guessing. That might be a little off, but yeah.
Is there a voice of South Asian? Or do you feel somewhat isolated being the brown guy here?
No, I mean, first of all, I don't necessarily work on South Asian issues here, so I'm not.
No, but I'm just saying, like, even just like staff, like walking around the office.
Right.
Like, how many?
Yeah. No, not at all. I mean, there's definitely other South Asians here. I can think of. We've sort of had like between, you know, like a handful of us over the time I've been here.
So there's definitely you're not the only
one. I'm definitely not the only one. Right. And you know, and I feel very comfortable and at home with people of color in general and white people. I grew up around white people too. So
yeah. I wanted to ask about the get into more specifically about the work that you're doing now.
Sure.
It's fascinating. Sure. But yeah. I did want to ask that you just mentioned that there are like specific South Asian issues. I'm curious if you could as we've been hearing more and more as we've been getting to, you know, speak to not only SALT, but, you know, DIPA and, you know, the Asian Law Caucus, that immigration, you know, wage theft is a big thing in there. What are some of the specific issues on a policy level that you guys are seeing? And are there structural things in place that our community should know about that we are facing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you commented on how striking it was that in the Indian undocumented population is the fourth largest undocumented population in the country, which is, when I saw that too, it was floored. And so clearly immigration is a huge one, which you mentioned. And the people at SALT can tell you a lot more about this, but hate crimes is a big one, sort of hate rhetoric and hate crimes.
Right.
So Deepa mentioned Oak Creek, of course, and there are several others that are maybe not at that scale, but certainly like hate violence against individuals is key. It's something that's been increasing and something that we need to pay a lot of attention to. And to me, that's a really tragic, but maybe a good entry point for our communities, because it's all about perception. It's about, you know, being seen as outsiders. It's about being seen as, you know, not American, like Deepa mentioned also. And so...
Yeah, because it seems like as a community, we're fortunate that we don't have a lot of structural things to overcome. And maybe I'm wrong with it. This is my, you know, learning again about the Asian Exclusion Act, but then in 65, how that changed, thanks in large part to the civil rights movement.
Sure.
This seems like that was the big structural obstacle for us. So it seems that that would be because that is our way in, right?
Yeah, yes and no, because I think that's partly how this model minority myth was constructed, right?
That's
so
true.
So to the extent that maybe a lot of us have some level of privilege that where we don't face, say, like, you know, economic barriers, there's certainly like a pretty large subset, I think, of the South Asian population that do face those things. And I think our challenge, especially if we are coming from a privileged place, is to some organization, I can't remember who, came up with this term, the model minority mutiny, where you sort of rebel against this model minority myth. Even if you feel like you are part of sort of the privileged part of like South Asians with some of the advantages that the model minority myth sort of created, the idea that South Asians who sort of fall within that model minority paradigm are obscuring some of the challenges and barriers that other South Asians are facing. Right. That's another good place for us to maybe.
Yeah, no, I think it's important. I just did that. And so I'm glad that you said that. No, yeah. But that, no, but it's even inherent in like the language we can use can sometimes, you know, it's very ingrained. It's like a very strong narrative.
Right, right.
That even as someone who has always been aware of that, and like someone myself I'm referring to, who was like really excited when I was on Nurse Jackie that I was a nurse and not a doctor and that I was bad at my job because I was like, yeah, fuck the model minority thing. But even there, it's like it's so ingrained in certain ways that it's like so important to keep checking ourselves.
Right, right.
Or having people check us on what that is.
Yeah, and I think it's just nuanced, which is really challenging, right?
Absolutely. It's like, man, we're lazy. People, we're lazy. Let's be honest. We get comfortable and we want to stay comfortable because it's the status quo. Why fuck with it? But
probably a stasis.
Yeah. So I think it is. It takes a certain amount of, you know, courage and it's difficult.
Yeah, and I mean it's in our face too. Like there are so many successful South Asians. There really are. And it's in our face with like CEOs of major, you know, Fortune 500 companies. It's in our face in Hollywood now to some extent. I mean, better than when I was your age, certainly. But like I think, you know, the fact that there are still a lot of South Asians that are struggling. So one way that we can really, one thing we can start to promote and think about is this idea of disaggregated data. So in the sense, for instance, like really creating categories that get at like, you know, Bangladeshi, Sri Lankans, Pakistanis, like within the South Asian identity to really find out more about how these subpopulations within South Asians are doing. Like, you know, how are they doing economically? Like, what's their story?
You know what makes me concerned when I hear something like that is while I'm like logically and intellectually, that makes a ton of sense. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned that because we're such a separated community from those regions, that if we start separating the community, I worry that it'll be harder, that it'll be easy. We'll say, well, that's just like a Pakistani problem.
Right, right.
Hopefully I'm wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's something I'm just like...
That makes a lot of sense.
That's something I just worry about.
Yeah. You know, I think it's a really good question, but it's a really good point. But I think at some level, we are like our own communities, right? Like you... you may be like Punjabi or, you know, I'm Tamil. And so we're like, I'm like Tamil Ayer, right? So if you build up from there, you know, I sort of reject that caste part of it. And I'm trying to like learn more about how the caste that I was born with sort of affects my worldview and how I can be a better ally to, you know, to Dalits and others who aren't traditionally like high caste. But I am, you know, I definitely view myself as a Tamil, you know, cisgender, straight male. And then I build up from there. But I'm an ally to other groups. I'm also a member of, like, the Indian community, Indian American community. I'm also a member of the South Asian community. So I'm also a member of the people of color community. So sort of, like, starting from where you're...
How do we create... Because a lot of people will say, well, I'm in this community, therefore I don't have to deal with the other. So, again, how do we encourage the alliance?
Right.
How do we encourage that?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Because I think that that's like key, because I think that it's fine to recognize your differences with people as long as you understand that there's still like responsibilities to other communities and there's like bridges that are still there between other communities.
Yeah,
and I'm always curious as how, because I'm fortunate that I was raised in a certain way that I know that, right? And that's how I was taught.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just a particular benefit, but like that's... I'm wondering, how do we encourage that in the pop? Because I don't know that I see that enough in our community.
Sure.
Making a very bold statement, general statement as someone, just one human being, not as some sort of spokesperson.
Right, right. That's an excellent, excellent question. And I think I see it too. So, you know, even in my own, like, friend circles,
right.
I see it. Yeah. And I don't think the answer is denying your sort of more granular community, because I think that is...
Okay, that's an interesting... That's a good point.
Yeah, because, you know, I am a Tamil American, but I don't really think of myself as Tamil when I'm with a bunch of other brown dudes. I think of myself as South Asian, you know what I mean? Like, so it's never a barrier to, like, connecting with folks, But it's not. But it's a part of me that I don't want to necessarily deny. So I think on one level you have to sort of want to achieve solidarity with other communities. You have to. I mean, so one path, my path, is understanding what we have in common compared to, like, you know, white people who are the system that and the way the system interacts with white people, right? So, and with the white community, there are certainly allies, but for us to say that no, we're just South Asian, don't think of yourself as Indian, I think also, you know, runs the risk of us not recognizing the advantages we may have as Indian, especially as Indian Hindus, say, where we're not necessarily going to be targeted by Islamophobia. And so, unless, of course, we're perceived as Muslim, which is also a concern. But I think one, I mean, and that's maybe a good way to think about how to build solidarity. So I'm not Muslim, but some crazy white supremacist dude probably doesn't care about that. You know what I mean? Like, he sees me as a brown outsider. I might as well be Muslim. And so to the extent that that's a connection I have with, like, brown Muslim people, even though I'm not Muslim, that's one answer maybe to, like, why you may want to build solidarity, even if it's not natural to you.
Right.
With people of color, for instance, like Suresh Bhai Patel, who was,
it was horrible.
Exactly. And he was called in. So for those who may not know, he was a victim of police brutality, I think in Alabama. And the 911 call said there was a black guy walking around the neighborhood who they didn't recognize.
First of all, this is an elderly gentleman. Exactly. Severe, like, he's in his, I don't know his exact age, but he's definitely 60 plus.
Exactly.
What?
He's a dada.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a grandfather. He's literally a grandfather. And, to the extent that I feel like we should be allies to black communities regardless of, like, the threat it poses to our communities. But there's a direct connection where anti-blackness may have had a hand in how that, you know, grandfather was treated. And so to say, oh, we're Indians, we don't need to worry about black problems or problems black communities face, I think is really short-sighted, especially when you have someone like Trump, who's like one of the it's going to be one of the two major nominees no matter what.
The funniest nominee, for sure.
The funniest, yeah. I mean, probably a goldmine for your line of work, but but really scary for people who look like that, who look like us. And so if that doesn't, like, drive people of color together to, like, want to achieve solidarity against this clear, you know, this guy who's spouting clear racist rhetoric, then, you know, that this is maybe our moment to really try to achieve that solidarity.
Perfect segue into the work that you're doing now, as you bring up Suresh Bhai Patel. Yeah. You are working mainly within reforms for its police. How would you phrase it? You phrased it better than I'm going to.
Yeah, I mean, we call it community-centered policing. So it's really about policing that takes the needs of all communities into account and treats all communities with respect and dignity. So what that typically means is police being accountable, police being transparent, police being fair, and just. And so, I mean, everyone knows, you really literally would have had to have been, hibernating to not know that there have been a lot of high-profile police brutality cases over the past couple of years in the mainstream media. And so,
can I ask you a question about that?
Yeah, sure.
Is it that this has always been a problem and those just kind of brought it to the surface? Mm-hmm. Or was this indication of an increase?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely always been a problem.
Right.
I think the advent of cell phones has made it
more apparent.
Much more visible. Yeah. And so, and the reason why I say that isn't, it's speculation to some extent, but because we don't have the data, unfortunately, but it's what, black and brown communities have been saying for generations.
Right.
And frankly, there's evidence that shows that police departments were directly evolved from, like, slave patrols back in the day, and, like, were directly evolved from, like, these armed bodies that were there to protect white people's property. And so to the extent that
it's something inborn in the institution, almost.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not necessarily fair to some police departments that are, trying really hard, especially at this point, to institute some of these better practices. But there's something there. I mean, there's absolutely anti-blackness, anti-brownness displayed by every major city's police department, certainly, and so, if not every police department. And so, to the extent the germ of that maybe comes from something deep-seated and historic. I think we have to take a look at that.
So that's you said the term better practices. Mm-hmm. That's interesting because you guys are policy. Mm-hmm. What can you accomplish when it feels like the focus has been on training? Mm-hmm. But are there policy? Is that policy? Mm-hmm. Or are there like actual policy initiatives, whether it's legal or like on like laws that need to be put in place? Mm-hmm. What can be done from that side of things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, like practices can be mandated by policy, right?
Okay,
so cool. That's one thing. I'll save my plug for the end, but we have a toolkit online where anyone can just sort of access it, and it's That's called justiceinpolicing.com. And so if you go there, you can see sort of these buckets of different policy arenas that advocates can start fighting for in their own communities to ensure that their police departments are as transparent and accountable as possible. But yeah, so there's oversight is a huge sort of bucket. So you want to make sure you have an independent body that really looks at police departments, whether their policies are up to date, whether they're actually following their policies, whether police officers are being held accountable for misconduct. So there's a whole suite of policies that can help improve police practices there. There are a number of, you mentioned training. So I think, people are split about trainings. I think some folks, see trainings as more money that goes to police departments that they can sort of use how they want, and they can just throw on a video for an hour or two, and that's a training. Does it really lead to change?
Right.
So some people, if there has to be training, or if training is really the answer, say that training should come from the community. It should be extended. It should be regular and recurring. But a lot of people talk about like implicit bias training. So are you familiar with implicit bias?
At all? Is that unconscious bias training?
Yeah, exactly.
Same thing.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, I'm just hearing about this in the last 2 days.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's something that as I'm hearing about it, I'm like, can we do this for everyone?
Right,
I think this should be part of school.
Yeah, I totally agree. And everyone can do it. There's the implicit association test that Harvard offers for free.
Blink, that's a big part of Blink, right?
Maybe, yeah, I read that a little while ago.
Yeah, yeah, I think that... But it's like photos you like, and you have to click something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I've done that. Yeah. It's fucking fascinating.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I didn't realize it was the same things. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So what that does is measures, I mean, it doesn't, I mean, it sort of measures your implicit bias towards one category or another, whether if you have it. And so it could be like young people, old people, it could be white, black people, et cetera. And so really what it is just a way for our brains, like our brains just, we're only wired to sort of observe a certain number of characteristics out in the world. And so this goes back to like our, hunter-gatherer days where we had to like see something quickly, assess whether it was a threat or not, and then determine what to do like in our subconscious brains. And so that same brain mechanism has now sort of been co-opted by like what we see, say, in the media, where you see like black people represented largely as criminals. So if you see a black person, maybe your brain sees that person as threatening or dangerous because of like what you've been learning in the mainstream media.
Right.
So it's sort of the exact same response, like from a brain science perspective.
So a woman with the brown eyes, blue eyes, forget her name. Did you know about this?
Yeah, the Iowa teacher.
Yeah, teacher. But her point was that if you leave high school, if you've gone through K-12 in the public school education and you are not racist, it's a miracle.
Yeah.
And her point is just about the programming, like the way that the curriculum and education and just like society is set up for that to be the case. And oftentimes it's unconscious because most people aren't choosing to be racist. It's a lack of awareness of whatever's going on.
Right, right, exactly.
At least that's my hope.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. And I think... for me, certainly that is my hope too. I think that's the optimistic view, that if there is prejudice, racism, it's sort of like unknown and people are just sort of, if they could only figure out that they were being unconsciously biased, then they would stop it, right? And we would sort of come to
that. Well, I think that's where awareness becomes the key, and then they have to practice it, right?
Right?
That becomes the second point.
Exactly.
That I don't want to be naive to leave that out. But I think that maybe it is really naive to believe that.
No, I don't think that's naive. I think you have to sort of be a self-starter and motivated to want to sort of like train yourself against those biases.
Right.
But then there is also like just people who are just racist, who are explicitly racist, right? And that's being played out more now, I think, with like the Trump campaign, for instance, where people are just, I feel like they're just bolder and just are willing to say what they actually think.
If nothing else, I feel like at least now it's out in the open, and hopefully if nothing else, we can now start to say, oh, wow, this is... this, because I think that for a long time it's kind of slipped under the surface.
Yeah.
And people like comedy, like what was Bill Burr saying the other day on the phone? Comedy, sometimes people now just know what words not to use.
Right.
But the thought still is like completely underneath
whatever
they're saying.
Right, right. Yeah. And I'm like going back through my childhood, I'm like, people like didn't really talk in that way, but like were there coded languages I just missed? And like, because I grew up like, totally believing in like the colorblind myth, totally like, you know, like feeling like, oh, it doesn't matter like what race we are. It doesn't matter like what color skin we have. We can just, you know, all be people.
But I think and that's where this looping it back to this equity conversation versus equality, I think becomes really important, because I think too often people here get equality and they're like, well, everyone's got one box and that's enough. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really important kind. We're running out of time, so I want to. You mentioned a plug. Is there anything that you had wanted to close with?
Yeah, I mean, just justiceandpolicing.com. If you're interested in like changing, you know, how police operate in your community, that's definitely.
And you're saying this is something any individual can like look at this website and have actual tools for what they themselves, as an individual, as a private citizen, can do.
Yeah, it's definitely a toolkit for. Advocates, like advocates who are working on that, who want to sort of organize their communities. Or
I think you're highly overestimating what our listenership is.
Oh, you never know.
I'm teasing
the guests that you were telling me about, like in the Bay, you're going to pick up an activist advocate community, a listening community for sure.
That's going to be fun.
Yeah.
God knows we want the activist community to listen to our entertainment podcasts.
Well, hey, we all have to achieve solidarity, activists, like entertainers, all of us together. So we're gonna be the majority in just 20, 30 short years, right? So
it's crazy.
As people of color.
So you put like justiceandpolicing.com.
Justiceandpolicing.com you know, policylink.org, definitely if you're more interested in equity. We definitely have more materials on that. And yeah, just feel free to reach out to me if you're more interested in equity or anything else that we're doing.
And how's the best way for them to reach you? Twitter? Is it
Anand@policylink.org. I'm on Twitter, yeah.
Hey man, he just threw out the email address. Get it, man.
I'm always on email, so it works. Yeah.
Anand@policylink.org. Yeah. And on Twitter, what is your Twitter?
A Subramanian, SubramanIan.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you guys.
So much
great.
For coming on the show.
It, yeah.
Guys,
Look, here's the deal, guys. You know we record our episodes in advance because we live in different places. We are done for the year. This is the last interview, so I don't even care what you do anymore. I'm done telling you to rate the podcast. I'm done telling you to review the podcast. You're abject failures at being fans.
This is going to be really confusing to people if we release this in a couple weeks and it's not the last podcast for the year.
You know, they shoot movies out of order. I'm ruining all the magic right now. All right? Santa's not real. The Easter Bunny isn't either. What you want?
But seriously, as we want to be able to bring amazing people like this and bring it to as many listeners as possible as we start to build our community, but also spread actual, like, really important information and really things that I think that we can have really important discussions around that people can bring to their communities, whether it's their family or their friends. So we need your help in just sharing the word. You know, if this is an episode that meant something to you, tell us your friends about it, or share the link, or text people about it, retweet our tweet, share our Facebook post. All of that, it becomes really helpful for us, and we appreciate those of you who have our ratings on iTunes have definitely increased, and we really appreciate that, and we know people are liking the page and sharing it, so we do really appreciate everything you guys are doing. We're going to come back at you next week with another dope content, whether it's the end of the year or not. I am Arjun.
I'm Akash.
And we'll catch you then.
God bless.